From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to Soundings, American Themes, this week on Soundings. My guests are two historians of American culture, Jack Green of the Johns Hopkins University and R.W.B. Lewis of Yale University. First on this edition of Soundings, a conversation with Jack Green about recent developments in the writing of American colonial history. Following that, a discussion with R.W.B. Lewis about 19th and 20th century American literature. Jack Green, you're a historian from Johns Hopkins University. Let's begin with some real generalities. What's new in early American historical studies?
Well, when I first went into this field 35 years ago, everybody discouraged me because they said that there wasn't anything to do. It had all been done. And this was, given the prevailing conceptions of history at that time, I suppose that was true. During the first generation of professional history in the United States, so beginning about 1875, 1880.
Frederick Jackson Turner?
Well, even before that, the people even who trained Frederick Jackson Turner.
I see.
Herbert Baxter Adams at my institution at Johns Hopkins, where graduate study in history began in this country. These people were concerned with those early years, with the founding period, with colonization, with the American revolutions, with the really beginnings of American history. But then by 1915, 1920, interest in that area collapsed.
When you say that they were concerned, what were they concerned about?
Well, they were concerned about the formation of American institutions, the history of the development of liberty in America, the history of American religious ideas, and a whole variety of things, which just attracted student after student who did dissertation after dissertation. This was mostly an institutional style of history, which was a style of history not only in the United States, but in Germany and France and England.
Well, what happened to make that fall out of fashion?
Well, what happened was that people exhausted that track of that way of looking at things. They had looked at almost all the places, at almost all the times that could be examined. And so the subject did appear from that point of view to be all done. Hadn't been very well pulled together. Various people tried to do that with more or less success, but there wasn't a great deal of interest from about 1915, 1920 until the mid 1950s.
All right, Jack Green, you mentioned religion. Be specific for me. What have you got in mind there?
Well, there's been an enormous amount of work done on the religious history of the early colonies,
and the
Puritans especially. Yeah. They're the most interesting group, partly because they were the most sophisticated theologically. They were the most learned. That is, they included the most learned people among the immigration, and they were most concerned with those kinds of issues. But this concern has inevitably spilled over into places that were far more secular in their orientation, which is almost all of the other colonies outside of Massachusetts and Connecticut, into a concern with the development of religious life in those places, with the rise of denominationalism, with the different social basis of appeal of one denomination against another, and with the development of a genuinely deeply religious culture in America, generally, not just in New England, but all over what became the United States at the end of the 18th century, in the wake of the American Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
For one thing, what we have learned at the most general level, what we've learned in the most powerful way is that these colonies were really outposts of British society, or English society, if you will, in the first days, in the Western Atlantic.
Mm-hmm.
And they were also part of a gigantic sociocultural creation, mostly by West Europeans, coming out of the 16th and 17th century that really covered the whole Atlantic world. It stretched from England and France and the ports in the Baltic down to the west coast of Africa, to all of South America, and certainly the eastern coast of North America and the whole of the Caribbean. This was all sort of one giant socioeconomic unit in which all the parts of which were deeply interconnected one with another.
Not just some little New England coterie headed by people like Cotton Mather and...
That's right. I mean, they're a part of a very broad world. And even within that world, there's a British world. And this British world consists not just of England and of what we now think of as the 13 colonies that seceded, but it also included all the West Indian colonies and places like Barbados and Jamaica were reckoned to be of much greater importance than many of those 13 colonies, which later seceded and became the United States. It includes Canada and Ireland. I mean, this whole world of the North Atlantic, stretching as far south as Barbados, is part of a common cultural is a common cultural enterprise.
Are you telling me, Jack Green, that the new historians today are finding in early American history a sort of counterpart to what we now call the Third World? Things that we have overlooked and that we have been flatly insensitive to, if not unaware of by accident somehow.
That's right. It's not only that we've broadened our geographical appreciation of the geographic scope of the interconnections, but it's also that we have seen that early American society is not just composed of merchants, preachers, and planners.
Yeah.
It's also composed of a great variety of people who are producing things on the land independently. It's composed of large numbers of white servants imported from England who can't pay their own way and have to sell themselves into servitude. And sooner or later, all up and down throughout the British world, even in England itself, it's composed of, in some significant part, in black slaves who have no hope of ever being free, or at least had no hope until the end of the 18th century.
Mm-hmm.
And also, let me say that it's composed of women and children who receive very, very little attention until the last 20 years. Objects of historical attention. There are a lot of peculiar things about New England. One very peculiar thing was that the mortality there was very low.
Cool.
Partly because it was less barren of Indians who had already died off from disease brought by earlier contact with Europeans, and also because they may have had less contact and may have lived in a more isolated way from the outside world, and perhaps also because it's slightly cooler and germs don't... I mean, whatever the reason, there's certainly a much lower mortality in New England than in contemporary England. Almost everywhere else, there's a rather high mortality in the early days. So what you get is an incredibly improvisational family structure in which neighbors are taking in children and relatives are taking in children. Very few children are being raised by their natural parents, for instance, in the Chesapeake. And the values that parents try to inculcate in children outside of New England, where they inculcate obedience to parental authority and the power of the father, everywhere else they're trying to inculcate autonomy.
Mm-hmm.
Try to help these kids stand on their own, because there's not going to be anybody around directly interested in them later on. And this value of autonomy, of course, which is very powerful in American culture throughout the 19th and 20th centuries and even into the present, really didn't grow out of early New England. It grew out of experience in all these other places, the Chesapeake, the so-called middle colonies in Pennsylvania and New York, and in the lower South, in South Carolina, North Carolina,
but
Georgia.
We would normally associate it with some of these New England figures.
The central element in American cultural history from the beginning has really been the idea of the individual pursuit of happiness, expressed in the Declaration of Independence, by which they meant that every person ought to be able to do what he or she can within the limits of their own abilities and the opportunities available to them. And that's been true from the beginning. This other idea, the idea of national election, is has been, a powerful idea after the Second World War, when a lot of this, from out of which a lot of this scholarship got its impetus, has been much less interesting.
Mm-hmm. You're telling me, Jack Green, that for all the complaining that we do about infighting, right now in the 1980s, about American politics and American culture, going at buffets with ourselves has really been built into it from the beginning, and we should be glad that it's there.
That's right. Uh-huh. That's right. Exactly. I mean, this has always been a society rooted in jealousy, in a sense, and a jealous regard for one's own individual space.
Uh-huh.
And that's been very powerful. In my view, fraternity has always been a weak idea in America. Equality, except for equality of esteem, which is necessary for the realization of oneself, has always been a weaker notion than liberty, for instance.
Mm-hmm. Jack Green, let's be specific. Talk to me about this issue of what? Human nature, political structures, the evolution of our American institutions. Pay some attention for a moment to race.
Well, one thing you must recognize, that the culture out of which these colonies came was deeply exploitative. Hmm. That is, people who had the capacity to exploit other people didn't hesitate to do it. It was common. And that was true throughout English society, and not just English society, but throughout the Western world.
Now, wait a minute. You're going to set some stereotypes on their ears here. We mm-hmm. have a lot of people going around this country telling us that we come out of a long-standing history of charity, compassion, if not specific forms of Christianity itself. That's pretty tough what you're saying there about the way people have, used people.
Exactly. Well, you can look at the way Englishmen routinely treated servants or hired people, it's very difficult to call this charitable.
Uh-huh.
At the same time, however, it's also true that the amount of money spent for poor relief in England was significantly greater than it was in any other European society at the time.
Uh-huh.
So there is a charitable dimension to English culture, and there was also an American colonial culture.
So you're saying that if we let people get comfortable enough by themselves, then there's going to be a sort of natural overflow of what, charity or welfare or somehow...
Well, people can't just ignore... and there are certainly religious, religious imperatives that prevent them from mm-hmm. ignoring the destitution of others.
Right.
But there were whole categories of people in the American colonies who were systematically exploited. I mean, American freedom was built very heavily on black slavery.
Of course.
And black slavery was not limited to South Carolina and Georgia and Virginia.
Not to mention the backs of women and children.
That's right. The backs of women and of white servants, for that matter. People who were dependents. The category of dependents was not a small category in early American society, and it would have been surprising if it had been, because it was an enormously large category in European society at the time.
And this is what the new historians, as you call them, Jack Green, as they call themselves or have been called, this is what they are looking at.
Well, it certainly is. I mean, we have, I think, gone beyond the kind of conventional Marxist class analysis and looking at lower classes and upper classes to look at the social categories that were used at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And the categories were dependents and independents.
Mm-hmm.
There were those people who were beyond the control of any other person. They had enough money, they had enough land, they had enough wealth, they had enough power, so that nobody could control them. They were the independents. These were small in most Western societies. In America, they were much larger than they were in England or France, because there was so much land and there was so much opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
But there was still in America this large residual category of dependents. And a lot of these people were black and slave. And slavery, I think it's very interesting to point out, slavery was an expanding institution in all of the colonies except New Hampshire in 1760, on the eve of the American Revolution. It was a very important institution in Maryland, Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia, and all of those West Indian islands, of course. And it was not by any means a marginal institution in New York, Rhode Island, and New Jersey, are in New England cities, are in the city of Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. There is a substantial black population in all those places. Slavery is protected. It's not discouraged. And in fact, one of the most important revolutions, and this is something that's also been appreciated fully for the first time in the last 20 or so years, the most important revolution to happen at the end of the 18th century in many respects was not the American Revolution, not the French Revolution, but in fact the revolution in people's values that caused civilized places to condemn the institution of holding some people in bondage from which they could never escape. And that occurred contemporaneously with the American and French Revolutions. The development of anti-slavery thought, the development of the idea that slavery was something that civilized places didn't have. Mm-hmm. And that was a development that also helped, I think, to shape our priorities in American cultural history, because once slavery had become something civilized places didn't have, the South became peculiar and distinctive. But it wasn't peculiar and distinctive at the time of the American Revolution. I mean, otherwise, four of the first five presidents wouldn't have been Virginians. Virginian wouldn't have played such a preeminent role in the shaping of the American nation. Once that had happened, then American historians, I think, had decided not only that the South was peculiar, but that Americans probably ought to trace their roots to those places where slavery was weak. Mm-hmm. And that sort of denies the slave basis of the American Republican experiment, which is one of the things I think Justice Marshall was pointing out.
Jack Green is a professor at the Johns Hopkins University. During a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Jack Green is at work on a forthcoming study entitled Changing Identity in Early British Plantation America. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on American Cultural Themes continues now with a discussion featuring a recent visitor at the center. R.W.B. Lewis teaches at Yale University. He's written and edited books about Hart Crane, Edith Wharton, Walt Whitman, and Herman Melville. R.W.B. Lewis, welcome to the National Humanities Center. You have been called a thematic critic. You've written some books about major themes in American culture. One of them is the American Adam. You write about American innocence. Is that still a major theme in our culture?
I wouldn't think so. If you're talking about writing by the present younger generation, no, the themes of 140 years ago were indeed the then new emphasis, Emersonian emphasis, on the innocence of human nature opposed to the continuing Puritan emphasis on the inherited depravity of human nature. Uh-huh. And the various dialogues that resulted from that and the various combinations of ideas. I don't see that as a compelling issue in the younger writing, to call it so. It seems to me that what we see in the, what is for me the most interesting of the newer writing, are more questions of black experience, women's experience, in that terrible word, minority experience. I'm thinking of, for example, the two books by Louise Erdrich, which deal with Native Americans, Indians in North Dakota and elsewhere, or the wonderful novels of Toni Morrison and Alice Walker and Paul Marshall. That tying in with possibly a larger theme, which seems to be prevalent, the notion of estrangement in our culture.
Something that we're not familiar with.
Yes, yes.
Who amongst our writers today, R.W.B. Lewis, we look around and you cite, for example, Toni Morrison, and we have people like John Updike out on the West Coast, Wallace Stegner. Who are the people today that we're going to be remembering in 50 years who are going to be canonized, so to speak? You want to make some guesses on that?
Yes. It's always fun, isn't it? I don't have any doubt in my mind that Robert Penn Warren will be alive, I mean literally alive, 50 years from now. I'm not so sure about John Updike, frankly. I am fairly sure about Toni Morrison. The thing there with Toni Morrison is that she is a leading figure in what is really a very large and impressive movement of black women writers. Mm-hmm. I think some of the best writing today is being done by black women writers, and I mentioned Alice Walker and Paul Marshall and several others. The late John Cheever, I would look forward to his survival. But you have to predict, don't you, a cultural condition not entirely unlike 1987.
Because, in order for them to survive.
Because if it's as different as 1987 is from 1917, for example, I think all bets are off, except Robert Penn Warren. I'm sure he's going to survive. But granted, some kind of continuity, then I would pick some of the ones I mentioned.
Let's pause on Robert Penn Warren. Let's assume that many people have heard his name and really don't know that much about him as a poet. Why is he noteworthy of public attention?
Well, I'm going to call him Red Warren because I've known him so long and so well, and he's my younger child's godfather. Mm-hmm. Red was born in 1905. He's now 82. Mm-hmm. He is the greatest man of letters in the 20th century, and perhaps, in the meaning of that phrase, man of letters, the greatest we've ever had. And by this I mean a writer who performs at a high or the highest level in every form of literature, in fiction, short stories and novels, in poetry, verse drama, criticism, critical essays, cultural essays like The Legacy of the Civil War, or Who Speaks for the Negro. So the sheer magnitude of his literary achievement is one of the things to emphasize. Author of at least two splendid novels, All the King's Men and World Enough in Time. Mm-hmm. Most of us, or at least many of us, think that the poetry written since the early 1950s, the last 30 years or so, are his supreme literary achievement. What he does, at least, in his poetry, in the best of his poetry, is mingle very common speech, very familiar common speech, even very familiar vulgar speech, mm-hmm. with what we'd think of as more higher poetic rhetoric. So it makes it more accessible to many a reader. Mm-hmm. He's superb at the capturing the speaking voice, especially a Southern speaking voice, in a state of excitement or anger, because Warren comes out of that extraordinary Southern Renaissance after the First World War, with writers like Alan Tate and John Crow Ransom and a number of others, the most powerful movement, certainly in poetry, of the post-World War I period. So Warren is the voice of that, of that movement.
R.W.B. Lewis, some literary critics are now saying that it is the critic, the person who does what you do, who's as important as the original expressive voice. There's a tall order for you.
Well, it's not only tall, it's impossible, in the sense that I got so disgusted with the developments in literary criticism that I have turned away from it. In fact, it's been a long time since I really call myself a literary critic, and my own interest has been much more in biography, literary biography.
Edith Wharton, for example.
Edith Wharton, and after that, an incomplete book, but on the members of the James family. You know the old saying, some of my best friends are in fact what they call deconstructionists or post-deconstructionists. And as you say, that one of the ideas that has been taking hold in certain places in parts of English departments is the notion that language is independent of the human user, that it gets away from human control, which seems to be partly true, but what else is new? I mean, that doesn't interest me to linger over that. I've found the developments in literary criticism to repeat some of my closest and dearest friends, some of those developments are anti-literary, anti-historical, heaven knows, anti-humanistic, mm-hmm. to which my friend says, you're so right. That's what we want to be. So I personally, traditional or no, I suppose so, but I certainly am interested in history and I'm a humanist. And
let's talk, R.W.B. Lewis, about your work as a biographer. I love to ask questions such as the following. How do you figure out the difference between the work and the life? Mm. You looked at, you've written a book about Edith Wharton, for example. Do you look at both and try to, what, weight one as opposed to the other? How does that work?
Never-ending question, I would suppose, for the biographer, especially since it's a not only a two-way street. I'll try to explain what I mean by that in a second, but it changes. A two-way street in the sense that clearly the life experiences have reverberations in the writing, in the work itself. These can be well concealed, or sometimes they can be quite obvious, or you can make connections. But the work can have an odd effect on the life. The person living the life sometimes turns out to be reenacting something, in this case, was something she wrote 20 years before.
Yeah. I remember hearing a story about Hemingway being depressed for a time because he'd killed off a couple of his characters, mm-hmm. and he said, you know, I just hated to see the old boy go.
Yes, right. Yeah, I know it. And a third possibility, and I think every writer who survives long enough goes through this, the work affects the work. That is, a later work comes out of an earlier work. So all I'm saying is that the relation between life and work is endless and fascinating. I suppose one issue for the biographer is to what extent he is going to get into psychology or even psychiatry and see how the life experiences at great depths show up in the work.
Second guessing not only a writer's cultural circumstances, but getting inside that person's mind.
And
thin ice, isn't it?
Thin ice, especially if you end up by saying that somehow the writer's lying about what happened.
Uh-huh.
But I don't go in for that because I'm not trained in anything more than elementary, you might say common sense psychology.
R.W.B. Lewis teaches at Yale University. With Cleanth Brooks and Robert Penn Warren, R.W.B. Lewis is an editor of American Literature, The Makers and the Making. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on American Cultural Themes is available on cassette. Ask for program number 391. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. That's program number 391. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, a conversation about ancient and modern India. My guest will be Paul Courtwright of the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. Our topic will be The Goddess and the Dreadful Practice. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
American Themes. From British Plantation America to Black women writers in the 20th century, this week on Soundings. Some answers and insights from Jack Green of the Johns Hopkins University and R.W.B. Lewis of Yale University. American Cultural History, next on Soundings from the National Humanities Center.